readers. Welcome to Books Connect Us from Penguin Random House. This is a podcast about staying connected with each other and the stories and authors who inspire us. Today's guest is Adam Resnick, an Emmy Award winner who has written on Late Night with David Letterman, The Larry Sanders Show, HBO's Divorce, and who co-created the cult favorites Cabin Boy and Get a Life. As an author, Resnick penned the darkly comedic essay collection Will Not Attend, which Rolling Stone called an antisocial work of art, and the Chicago Tribune praised as a biting, darkly hilarious collection of personal essays that begs to be read aloud. Here's Adam Resnick in conversation with Penguin Random House video director Pat Stango.
So hi, I'm Pat Stango, the director of video at Penguin Random House, and I'm here with the very funny author Adam Resnick. He wrote the humor collection Will Not Attend. He's also known as a TV and screenwriter, wrote on Late Night with David Letterman, created the hilarious show Get a Life with Chris Elliott, wrote on Larry Sanders. He's writing on HBO's Divorce, a bunch of stuff. Adam, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks for referring to my book as the humor book, which I guess it is funny, but I just, you know.
You hate the word humor exactly as a description of your book?
Yeah, kind of. Not, by the way, not that I'm thinking it's, you know, has any great depth or is, you know, this novelistic heavy drama, but it's just like, yeah, humor book to me is, you know, a Garfield book.
Right, right. Okay. So how would you...
Garfield cartoon. To me, a humor book is Garfield cartoons, you know, those collections, because I have a ton of them. I'm sure you do.
Yeah, people love Garfield books.
Yeah, he's a funny cat. He's very, honestly, I've never read any of them, but I might get the sense that he's a little cranky.
Yeah, well, some people say you might be a little cranky. So I think, you know, you and That's Garfield would get along, possibly.
Yeah, maybe so. Wow, I'm thinking about Garfield more than I've ever thought before in my life. I can thank you for that.
You're welcome, Adam. So, I love the book. And one of the things that I love about it is that, you know, you write these essays about things that a lot of them, the connective tissue seem to be things and people that have annoyed you over the years, maybe brought you pain over the years. But The vibe of the book, as dark as it is, what I love is it never feels particularly mean. The vibe that I always get is a sort of we're all in this together because we're all annoyed together. The thing I want to ask you is you write about a lot of things that have annoyed you in your past, people that annoyed you. When you wrote about them and you're finding the comedy in it, was that a pleasant experience, or do you find yourself just getting mad all over again?
I really enjoyed writing a book, if I recall, and it was kind of easy. I don't know. It was a new thing, and it's probably what I was meant to do is just write, you know, the showbiz thing. I never really enjoyed, but if I have any talent at all, and I don't know on the spectrum where that talent is, I think it's just writing. And so it was, the anger thing, that's interesting. What you said, that's nice. That kind of makes me feel okay, because I think a lot of people don't feel that way. I never look at that book. It's hard to, you know, access how I felt, you know, get deep into the feelings of that now, because it's, you know, it's been a few years. The only thing that I would say about it is I wasn't pushing anything. I was writing pretty much from the way I was feeling. So I'd write those stories, the anger would come back, but in kind of a fun way, you know, right. And I would like, you know, it'd be more like, you know, and I would expand on just the way I was feeling. And that was okay. Other people tell me I shouldn't feel this way, but I feel like maybe it could have been toned down a little bit, maybe a little less swearing and that kind of stuff. But I don't use, you know, profanity for a laugh or anything. Literally, it's the way I grew up hearing my father talk. It's the way that I usually talk. And so there was a lot of that in it. So I think for people that don't, who may not like the book, it comes off I think I just come off as a horrible asshole, which, you know, there's a lot of that about me too. But what you said is sort of what I think I had hoped the book would be like. You know, I wasn't consciously thinking that that's what it was, but I was, and I didn't try to inject certain things that were unnatural to make it, to soften it. But those things, I think, do exist in there. Maybe there could have been a little more. I guess that's what sometimes I think I would, if I could go back in time and do it over again. But I don't really think about it too much. I don't think about the book. I you know, if there's enough people that I respect that seem to like it, it's not for everyone, though.
Yeah, I mean, I love it. You talked about writing the book compared to some of the other writing that you've done. You've, you know, spent most of your career as a TV writer, screenwriter. What makes you say you felt more comfortable or more natural writing these essays as opposed to writing screenplays, writing television that other people are going to produce?
Well, it's about control. It's like the book is the end of it. And that was a really great feeling. It's not I enjoy, if I'm writing a script for something or whatever, if I'm writing something that is going to be thinking for a TV or a movie or something like that, if I like it, if it's not something I'm writing, you know, for the money, but if it's something that I like and I can get into that part too. The best part for me is writing the script. If I write a pilot that I feel good about, which I, you know, I haven't really attempted that in a while because I'm not so interested, because I never finishing the pilot and people saying, oh yeah, this is a great pilot. This let's, you know, now let's develop it. Let's try to pitch it, turn it into a show. That's when the air comes out of everything for me. It's like the pilot was enough. I kind of like the pilot. I don't want to go through all the, machinations of putting it on its feet and on a, you know, on a stage and casting and all that other stuff. That's the part I've never enjoyed. And I'm definitely going to write another book, and I want to write fiction. I don't want to do another book like the one I've done. I don't want to, you know, those are all the stories I have to tell, really. The other thing with the book is, you know, it's on me if it doesn't come out good. And there's a lot of stuff in my book that I would rewrite or do a little differently, you know, but I, you know, sentences that make me wince. I haven't looked at it. I mean, the last time I looked at it was, I don't know how many years ago, and everything I looked at, I didn't like.
Does that seem to be something in general with you and your work? It's just hard to look back on it and not feel like you want to change everything about it.
Yeah, I think that's common for everyone, I would assume. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'd have to be very sure of yourself. And there are some people that are just that good. I'm sure they, you know, they wrote something great, it turned out great, and they can feel proud of it. But I'm just, I'm not really like that.
Do you have any consideration that you would ever do a filmed version of Will Not Attend?
No. It would have to be, no, I don't think so. There was a couple, you know, after I wrote it, I had some offers for TV shows to, you know, that they wanted to option the book and have me do a series, but I just knew there was nowhere to go but down. But if everything came good, if there was some kind of the right person, cool director, if, like, you know, all these people that came together and I thought that it could be pulled off, and it was, you know, every chapter was just, the thing is that the TV show, there'd be no through line. I would just have every episode be different. And I thought of that. People recently again have come to me about that, and in a weak moment, I might think, yeah, you know, there's something here, but I never thought about it deeply enough to try to figure out what that would be. And it just seems pathetic. It seems like, why would I do that now? And I'll never be able to say again, the book is just the book, unless I had a crystal ball and knew that the TV show would be, you know, even better than the book or the movie or whatever. And it's just not, I am programmed to believe, you know, through my past experiences, that everything gets worse once you try to dramatize it and film it.
So if Scorsese came to you though and he said, we've got the de-aging technology from The Irishman, we want to make this book, that might be the special case.
No, the special case would just be, I don't have to be the most, I don't know what the special, I don't know what the circumstances would be that would make me feel confident enough to do that. And by the way, when I say that, these are my own personal feelings, when I say that things all fall apart after, as you're taking, you know, something, a script, and then turning it in, it gets turned into something, you know, I've had no luck with that whatsoever. It's just some my fault, and a lot of things, oddly, just that were out of my control, that stupid decisions that I've made that, looking back, that's the only decision I would have made at the time. So I don't even really regret that. working for Letterman, which was such an important thing, it was my first job. And I always say it's like the greatest job I ever had because it was my first job. And I never believed that I would, you know, be doing anything. I never thought I'd be successful at anything. And that show was so right for me. And that was a whole different thing in a different era. And writing things on that show or getting little silly things produced, I did like that. And they weren't so silly. You know, Letterman, that show had a certain attitude that was similar to my own, a cynical, you know, thing.
That's a show that, just as like a comedy nerd myself, was pretty much one of the first things I remember watching as a kid and really feeling like, oh, this is what funny is. The Letterman show in the late 80s and early 90s. And that does just seem like a dream job. You know, like a dream sort of, you've got this really creative person at the head. You've got this almost like playground to do whatever you want. You're in a safe zone of being on so late that it's not as, you know, it's not quite as high profile where there's going to be a million different factors keeping you from doing certain things.
Yeah. And it was, there was really nothing else like it. You know, you'd have to forensically go back and examine, you know, what that show did as far as how it changed the culture, you know, and things became different. That's what, you know, people, you know, like Jon Stewart, who's so great in his own right, you know, I think Dave was the one who sort of made that possible. The downside is all the, you know, the bad, just the stuff that's not great that's also come out of that. But you can't, it's hard to, you know, analyze that and think or anything like that. It's like me saying there never should have been, you know, an internet now when I think about it. It's nothing, it's all bad. There's no reason for it. You know,
that is a famous statement of yours. There should never have been an internet.
It's just awful as much as it helpful and how great it is in other ways. So I can't wrap my head around the internet still.
Well, back to Letterman. So you were a writer on Letterman, and so right now, obviously we're going, you know, we're all in the middle of this pandemic, can't leave our houses, that kind of thing. And just in terms of late night TV, there are all these shows, you know, you've got the Jimmy Fallon show and Kimmel and all the late night shows are going back on the air doing what we're doing now, like just basically broadcasting over Zoom and Skype and like webcams.
Yeah.
And, you know, Fallon is doing the shows from his house with his kids running in, and everyone's doing their sort of their type of thing, but from home. What do you think the Letterman show would be like in a situation like this?
Dave doing a show from home sounds like something we would have done. And I think a form of that was done. I think Dave did something waiting for the cable guy to come once, you know, I don't know whether it was a remote or an actual show. So that was the kind of idea, the kind of things we would do back then. As far as how if this, you know, pandemic hit back in the 80s and we were doing the show, well, there wouldn't even be the technology to do it from home. You know, there wasn't no Zoom or any of that shit. If it was possible, I think Dave's show would probably, and I haven't, the only, of those shows that you've mentioned, the only show that I've seen parts of are Kimmel. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Dave's, I think it probably Dave's would feel like Kimmel, because Kimmel's just really good. I think he's like the best out there. Having said that, I haven't seen Colbert or Fallon or any of the other ones. I don't know. Is Arsenio Hall still doing a show? I don't know. I didn't see
that. I mean, now's the time to start if he's not.
Yeah.
Get in there.
That's right.
All the playing feels level. All you need is your laptop.
That's the thing about Letterman when I was there, which, you know, it's just hard for anyone. I think if you even see the clips on YouTube for a lot of people who were either too young or not even born then, I don't know that they would get it. Some of it they might. The one thing that was great is that was the show to watch. There weren't all these talk shows. It was just like, that was the new world was Dave. And then there was the old world. And it was so easy. You had no competition as far as thinking of, you know, if there's any topical humor, there was hardly anything to draw from.
Right.
It was very maintainable. I could never do that now. And I can't imagine what it's like working on a show where you have to, you know, worry that the other three shows or two shows are coming up with similar angles or jokes or whatever it is. And the pop culture is so vast now. I don't even know how you can get a handle on it. It was a lot easier back then.
Well, like even going back to Will Not Attend, which, like you said, came out a few years ago, but it's not topical humor. It's not pop culture. It's not like you wrote a book of, you know, Trump jokes 4 years ago. So it's the type of thing that is as funny now as it was a couple of years ago, and it'll be as funny in 10 years. Is that the type of thing you know, back when you were at Letterman, of course, you had to write monologue jokes about, you know, whoever the president was or whoever had a sex scandal. Are you glad to not have to write that type of thing and instead write these more evergreen stories, essays, you know, as opposed to writing like very topical material?
Again, that was not a conscious decision. That's literally the way that I am. Right. Even when I was writing for Letterman, that I tend not to like whatever period I'm living in. And I romanticized periods before I was born that I think would be a cooler time to live, even though we know there was maybe in some ways and other ways not. But you could argue now we're living in pretty awful times, pandemic aside. And there was something about commenting on topical stuff that never interested me. Even I wasn't one of the monologue writers, but I gave Dave like a few, they weren't even really jokes, a few things each day that were not topical, that were more just jokes like Dave, in, you know, first person comments for Dave to say about himself that he would always be amused by. And they would never get a laugh when he did them, but they amused Dave. And for me, that was the only goal. I was always writing just for Dave, not thinking about how anything would go over. It was just about if Dave thought it was funny, that was the win for me.
So you've been in New York for a while. And like I said, we're right in the middle of this, you know, everyone's locked in their house or trying to stay away from each other. I'm out in Queens. I haven't been to Manhattan in probably a month now. I've been working from home, but you're in Manhattan still, right?
Yeah.
So how is it? Like, what is the scene in the busiest place on earth when people are not supposed to go outside anymore?
It's, I don't know. It almost feels like I'm used to it now. There was never, every week I feel different. I feel a little different. I'm starting to, I think, go a little crazy with it as I realize, wow, this really is going to, we don't know. This is going for a long time. Things may never be the same. I don't know. That's starting to bug me now. But how many weeks have we been on this fucking lockdown now?
I think it's been exactly
4 weeks, 5 weeks,
a month. I think it's four. Yeah, it might be 5 weeks. I think at the time we're recording that, I think it is a full, we're in like week five.
Yeah, I guess it was the first 2 or 3 weeks, each week there was something different that made it, you were just moving forward, trying to figure out what to do. Like the first week felt just weird. And then there was a thing where you realized it was hard to get food and you couldn't get in, like there were lines were out, you know, down the block and they still are. It was hard to get things delivered, like Amazon Fresh, which I had never used before. We tried that angle and you couldn't even get a slot. I don't know if that's the case, but then soon that eased up a little bit. It's a little easier to get food now. And, you know, we try not to go out more than once or twice to actually go to the store, but we're outside every day. We have a dog to walk. And at night is when I usually go on a really long walk at night. And it's for a while it was kind of creepy because the streets were empty and it felt, I don't say dangerous, but it felt like it could be dangerous, which how often, you know, I've never felt that on the Upper West Side.
Right.
I felt that, at, you know, in Washington Square Park in the 80s when I was at NYU, but there'd just be few people hanging around that you realize, oh boy, I don't know about that. And also there were just no sign of police. So I both actually kind of liked the feeling because it felt, there's something exhilarating about maybe feeling a little danger again.
Well, it felt like 80s New York.
Just strange. Lately at night, it seems to be, I see some more cars and there might be some more people on the street. It doesn't feel quite the same.
When this first started, was there for you a little bit of, oh, this might not be so bad not having to go to events or see people that regularly? You know, was there any of that kind of thought, or did you immediately think, oh, this is, I hate this immediately?
It's funny. My life in that regard hadn't really changed that much. I mean, it didn't, you know, I was still seeing I saw, you know, I communicate with people that I know all the time, with a phone, on the phone or texting, which I actually absolutely hate texting. I turn my texting off. I can't stand the notifications and I hate having the text. But email, that's fine. So no, it doesn't. I wish the people were back on the street. If I were, you know, I guess this thing, I am kind of antisocial. I don't really think that's the word. It just doesn't do anything for me. I like being alone more, but I enjoy friends. I enjoy seeing friends and stuff. I just don't like to do a lot of stuff. And I think at least that title will not attend. It probably is more about, I don't like being expected to do things. I don't like having to worry about insulting people, which I have guilt about, you know, very easily. Like if an email comes in, I'm thinking, shit, do I have to respond to this right this second? Can I hold off texting? Same thing, this pressure to respond. Mostly I'll respond quickly, trying to get it off my plate, but then another text will come in. And that's, after a while, that I don't know, that gets to be too much for me. I don't know, right, if I'm answering your question. I can't even explain
why
I'm like that. But I've always been like that.
You hate obligations.
The happiest. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. It depends on what it is. I'm at the point now, if it's a social obligation, I don't want to do it. I just am not going to do it. But it's not even obligations. I just like being alone. You know, it's not in a way that I wish I walked out to a world where there was no other people, like, you know, whatever the 10 Twilight Zone episodes that covered that territory. It's not like that. It doesn't. So in that sense, no. In short, this whole thing is not, there's nothing that connects to that. They'll think, oh, this is probably, you know, this is really nice. I don't see people on the street anymore because I'm not literally, you know, like pushing people out of the way, like going, ugh, a human being, right, ugh, another one. It's not, but people can, you know, I can be annoyed easily. I will say that much more quickly than my wife can, obviously.
It also seems like the obligation side of life hasn't changed much even through this. Like, do you feel like we're just in a way sort of as busy as ever, you know, but it's just in a more annoying way where now everything has to be like this. It's like all of these computer chats and phone calls.
That's, oh my God, you really, like, you hit the nail on the head. That's what is bugging me the most now. And I feel like my whole day is crazy. You would think that I'd have all, they'll just feel like you could just sit around, watch movies, go for a walk, come back in, watch some more movies. It's not like, it is constant stuff like what you're describing. And you don't even know how the day gets away from you. Because sometimes it's things that are not really pressing, but the day does, it gets away from me. And that bugs me a little bit. I don't know why that is. You just articulated it though, you know, pretty well.
When this started, I mean, obviously there's no silver lining because it's terrible. But I did have the thought, well, there's going to be a lot of time to whatever. I'm going to finally get a lot of reading done or watch all these. And yeah, that definitely doesn't happen. There's somehow no downtime, even though we can't do anything.
Hard to see. And people reach out more because everyone's bored. I mean, I reach out sometimes. I mean, there's just times where I just feel like I'm kind of talked out and just don't want to. You know, and it's just difficult. I can't work at home, never could. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I can't go back to the place that I used to go to write in, which I hope is even still, you know, available when this thing ends. So it's, yeah, it's weird.
Last thing is, I know we just said how there's pretty much no free time, but has there been anything in particular that you've either been watching, whether it's like some movies that you wanted to catch up on or a book or anything that you would recommend to listeners? Is there anything that you've enjoyed sort of watching or reading the last month?
I'm watching that. Are you watching that Plot Against America?
I haven't. No, I haven't started that yet. The Philip Roth adaptation, right?
Yeah. It's pretty good, but also it's you know, legitimately kind of scary. You wouldn't, if this series was on 5 years ago, it would not be, you would just feel, that would be weird. God, how, what an awful thing to think that could happen. Could that ever happen? Probably not. But you watch it now and it's the timing of it makes it kind of scary. So I like that. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know why this is coming to mind, but, my brothers, my two younger brothers, had suggested to me to watch this documentary series on Vice called The Dark Side of Wrestling. And I'm enjoying every single episode. I love it.
Me and my wife watch that every week. That was one of the first things we did. And this is we bought the whole season on iTunes.
I see it on, I don't know, it just, we DVR it or something. Okay. Maria doesn't watch it, my wife doesn't watch it, but it's,
oh, we love
it's
it.
Amazing because, I was never, I would say, a wrestling fan per se, like one of those people screaming in the crowd at a wrestling match, but it was, you know, it was a part of growing up in Pennsylvania, watching wrestling on TV, and then they would come to the Zembo Mosque, which was this weird little place, and it was so I always had some fascination with it. I haven't watched wrestling though in, I know, such a long time, so I don't even know who the people are, but these little biographies and stories are fascinating. I really like that show.
Usually we recommend some books on here, but I'm glad that on this episode we're recommending a wrestling documentary.
But my daughter Sadie is in publishing, and so she's always recommending books to me that I like. And I just started this one that's already people are, I guess, talking about, called My Dark Vanessa. Just read it. It's about this. I think it took the author she wrote it over a couple of decades. I would say just read it. It's good. And I saw, what was the one I read before that? Nothing to See Here, about the kids that catch on fire. I liked that. I guess I gotta say My Dark Vanessa, because my daughter is so passionate about that book. She she had read some manuscript of it a long time ago, I think, it was just always talking about it.
So everyone should read My Dark Vanessa, and then read Will Not Attend, and then watch Dark Side of the Ring, and then hopefully after all that this the pandemic will be over.
The Dark Side of the Ring, it's a shame. I don't think there'll be many takers for that, but it's really great.
Thank you for doing this.
Thanks, Pat.
And we look forward to whatever you're working on now. And everyone, again, should pick up Will Not Attend. It is hilarious. So thanks a lot, Adam.
All right. Thanks a lot, Pat.
Thank you for listening to Books Connect Us. For more great book recommendations and information about your favorite authors, feel free to follow Penguin Random House on social media or visit penguinrandomhouse.com. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, go ahead and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it helps more listeners to find our show. This podcast is produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. I've been Erin Leaf, and until next time, this has been Books Connect Us.